Hello, and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. Modern life has become, for many people, a lonely trap. Material comfort is more than balanced by personal emptiness and confusion. We maybe mask that with work, with entertainment, with drink and drugs and sexual excess. And by masking it like that, we often cut ourselves off from the one person who can save us from that emptiness and return us to the fullness of our humanity. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest this hour has lived, if one can phrase it this way, at the very center of modern emptiness. Once a successful Los Angeles entertainment lawyer, John Carmichael, having met the light of the world, is a changed man now. He tells the remarkable story of his own rescue and restoration in his powerful memoir, Drunks and Monks, a book that Jennifer Fulweiler has called the seven-story mountain of our times. John Carmichael, thank you for being with us.
Cy, thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
So, Drunks and Monks, which category do you fall into, John?
Well, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so we affectionately refer to ourselves as drunks, but I've been sober for almost 7 years. So I'm a long way away from a cocktail, and I probably identify more with the monks these days.
Uh-huh. And do you find this that really the Catholic Church is about, I mean, whether your thing was drinking or something else, everybody's a reclamation project.
Right. Sure. I mean, it's the idea of brokenness and original sin and our wounded nature and redemption through the graces of the Church and all of that. It's so easy for me to see it now, and I was so completely blind to it before, that there was anything there for me in the Church or in the faith that would – or that there was anything that needed healing. There obviously was, looking back, but once you see it, it's hard to unsee it, you know, the truth of the faith and what's there for us. But I certainly began the book. It's definitely an ode to spiritual blindness, the beginning of it.
Right. And I think at a certain point in the book, a priest tells you that your story is Augustinian. And I suppose there are different, you know, there's probably a Pauline way to get there and a Petrine way to get there. But the Augustinian has its very severe highs and lows. And that's what you've experienced.
I've heard that a number of times. I was actually in formal discernment for the priesthood, and the vocation director said, your story is Augustinian. And I couldn't help but wonder if almost every story these days, unfortunately, not every story, but because of what we're exposed to, just by waking up in the morning, I mean, it's a shame that you know, it would be that way, but it seems like many of the stories now are almost of necessity. They're going to be Augustinian because of, you know, the institutionalized sin. It's hard to escape, and you know, and Saint Paul and Saint Augustine and Saint Ignatius and Saint Francis. That whole line I do identify with because they were so completely opposed to God. They had their back turned completely. And in each case, their conversion was very brutal. You know, there was a brutality in you know, the fall from the horse and all of these things. You know, they had to be injured. You know, those saints had to be hurt pretty badly, physically even, to just have that moment of quiet where God could possibly reach them.
And one of the striking things I think about this memoir, Drunks and Monks, again, is the name of the book, is that it's both very carnal and very spiritual, which struck me as, wow, this guy's a Catholic to his core. But it seems like a hard story. How should I put this? Like in the media atmosphere we have now, there are certain niche markets. And so you've got a niche market that the wider world would call it a niche market of Catholic publishing. And it seemed to me this would be a pretty hard sell to a Catholic publisher because it's raw, I suppose.
Yes. I tried to confine the profanity to one section. I was very conscious with my editor about this. There was a section that was very disturbing. It's the seventh part of the book. And that's the only area where foul language enters, and it enters in a kind of – it's recording things that actually occurred as opposed to the manner of expression. And I didn't want to scandalize anybody. I was very cautious about how I approached the ugly aspects of the book, but I felt that my perspective is that much of what we're exposed to is now it's overtly satanic, and in the same way that exorcists report the ugliness of what comes out of the mouths of the possessed people from the demons. It's in order to see the God's power and purity and clarity and beauty in this society, in this culture, which is, you know, largely pornographic, all of these things you could say about it, I felt that I had to reflect what I was living in. Yes. So that I could, so that the coming into the church would be, would have its a proper breathtaking quality. You know, when I first walked into the Junipero Serra Chapel, and just it happened to be the old rite, and it was it took the air right out of my chest. It was such a contrast to what I had lived in. So I guess I was setting it up because I wanted people to love the church like I love it, or love the Liturgy of the Hours that the Norbertines observe. If you've never seen anything like that and you're coming out of the culture, it I mean, it'll make you cry. It's so beautiful because it's such a sharp contrast. The church that is one holy, Catholic and apostolic, when you encounter it in her holiness, when you encounter the church in her holiness and you've come out of this, the world, the flesh and the devil, it's a shocking experience. And it's one that, from a literary perspective, I made certain choices that I, in order to get that impact, I felt I had to be, it was strategic. Everything that's in the book, I weighed consciously. There are incidents and anecdotes that I took out because I felt they were just too, like I said, I didn't want to scandalize people too much. So,
but in the other direction, however, the book is probably unacceptable to the average secular publisher because. While I have to say, and we'll talk, I really want to get in depth with you about this a little bit more. There's a scene at a certain part of the book in a bar that strikes me as so convincingly demonic and terrifying that I think any secular publisher would love that. Like, but the fact that you are drawn out of that into a world of light and a world of forgiveness and healing and really kindness is one of the most striking things I think you keep discovering. That wouldn't be acceptable to the secular publisher today.
Well, one has to wonder, you know, when you're talking about a secular publisher, what orders, and I don't mean to be, you know, tinfoil hat about this, but I mean, my thesis, of course, is that the Catholic faith is true. With a capital T, and there are a lot of people, even maybe some within the church, that feel that's not an appropriate thing to say in 2017 because of necessity, we know from St. Thomas Aquinas that A cannot be not A.
Yeah.
You know, if the Catholic faith is true, by implication, that's going to rule out competing philosophies.
Right.
And so this book says things that wouldn't necessarily get by the censors. I mean, I don't think it's – I was driving down La Cienega Boulevard last pilot season, and every billboard was – every show had to do not just with the – it was with the Prater Natural. It all had to do with Lucifer. I mean, a show.
There's a show called Lucifer, yeah.
And he's a buddy cop. And it was five or six of these things, and they all had to do with the occult.
Right.
So if I'm standing on the opposite side of that river and saying, you know, with the St. Benedict crucifix in one hand and the rosary in the other, saying – not only is God real, but the Catholic faith is true, and we all are called to, you know, not just repentance, but sacramental confession, and the Eucharist is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. I mean, I don't know any secular publisher that would stand for that for 5 seconds because
Right.
You know.
So it has the kind of rawness and realness of contemporary writing, but it has that twist of Catholicism that's not acceptable to the in the contemporary market. And so it stands as a kind of an odd work, but a delightfully odd work. I really think that, John, a beautifully odd work. And I think for me, I must say, part of it is Southern California is like a character in the book. Mm. It's like you're very specific about places and how these places differ from one another, how, you know, I don't – like Topanga is different from, you know, Costa Mesa or, you know, what,
yeah.
And they're very visceral. And living here and having grown up here, it's kind of – it's just cool the way you evoke that world.
Well, you know, there's people that are great at rebuilding the internal combustion engine, or they have talent in different areas, and I can't do that. I'm not good with cars, but I can. I'm a writer and I'm an artist, and so I absorb all those energies of you know what it's like to be in Laguna Canyon versus Topanga Canyon versus
yeah.
and why it matters, and so that I conceived of the book as a long poem. So it's full of – I wanted the imagery to be as rich as possible because that's the fun and that's part of the fun of reading is that
yeah.
people want those images and those subtle sensations you know, played out for them. So
right, right. And but another striking thing, however, though, is that Los Angeles is itself in some ways the heart of darkness. I mean I love Los Angeles and it is the city of angels. It's beautiful in so many ways and so many wonderful people there. But because it's the center of the world's media industries, entertainment industries, it's foul in many ways.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So your story actually plays out right at the heart of where the world is a mess.
Well, there's a strong Catholic presence in Southern California. And there's a contrast between, any power center. I mean, what do they say that Washington D.C. is Hollywood for ugly people? And then John McCain once said that if that's true, then Hollywood is D.C. for the simple-minded. So we're talking about two of the world's great power centers,
right.
Say D.C. and Hollywood. And what are we told by Jesus? We're told. That the you know we're warned about the world. We're warned. The church warned us about the world, the flesh, and the devil. So if you're right next to a worldly power center,
yeah,
and the devil is the prince of this world, then by definition, and so but you know the contrast became very clear to me when you think of the capital of our state, Sacramento, is named after the Blessed Sacrament.
Right.
I never thought of that before.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see the history of the missions and you see that you would have a group like the Norbertines or even closer to here, the Benedictines in Oceanside, and that there are people observing the Liturgy of the Hours. It's the spiritual warfare, if one is unaware of it, you if you stumble into one of these places, you see that St. Michael's Abbey, I mean, their patron is an angel that fights Satan.
Right.
We're not really talking about a symbolic fight. It's real, and so it's a good place to encounter the faith because the contrast is so sharp. It's so
right.
sharp.
But that's I suppose what I'm getting at is that you depict this world that for me is very very real. I
yeah.
think you make it so that for the reader it's very, very real.
Yeah.
And so it feels like the world that we live in, but it's also a world in which demonic activity is clearly pervasive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, a striking accomplishment, to see the world that we live in with almost like a new set of bifocals on, and you can look through the bottom half of the bifocals and you can see there's something really wrong here, and it's not just wrong like we made a mistake, but it's wrong like there are personalities here who truly hate us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I began the book, began the first part of the book, and I call it The City of Man, and I'm standing on top of Mulholland Drive, which is, you know, that was like, and I had just seen a client, we'd settled a big copyright case. He himself is a very famous writer and author, and I was just miserable. I was divorced, and I was about to get divorced, and I was looking down at the city. And I'd been in all these skyscrapers and different places and trying to get ahead. And it just felt not just empty, but but frightening. And I didn't understand this,
and I
didn't really know about St. Augustine's City of God, that many of our saints came to this same understanding I was about to come to. For example, one of my favorite scenes in The Exorcist was when and it's a subtle one. Only the Catholics would like this part. The protagonist priest is praying the consecration at a mass, and he's going through it kind of in a perfunctory way. But after he has his encounter with the possessed girl, with Regan, then they cut to him offering Holy Mass, and he's speaking the words of Christ over the Eucharist in as though he's hearing them for the first time.
Yes.
And that is kind of what my experience was like, cradle Catholic, altar boy, okay, you know. But suddenly now I can feel the chill of the demonic and I can see it, I can feel it around me without even really believing in it. And then I come to this new understanding, well, look at all the deliverance work that Christ was doing, and what does he mean when he's talking about the demons will be cast out and they'll come back finding the place clean and swept, but they'll bring seven more, and the condition of that man will be worse than the first? That means something to a recovering alcoholic, because when we see a relapse, it's like it's seven times worse than the first time,
right?
And the condition of that man is truly worse than it was. So the idea that there really are angels and demons is horrifying at first, but then you remember, well, that means that I have a guardian angel.
Uh-huh.
You know, well, excuse me, pleased to meet you. Sorry, Miss
sorry, Mr.
Guardian Angel. I mean, we're not supposed to name them or anything, but, you know, I'm sorry. You know, let me try. Boy, you must have yes, it's a really rough gig you've had the last 7 years. I mean,
right.
And then I could look back and I could see the presence of that kind of help, you know, where there were times when I was so incredibly vulnerable and could have gotten hurt. And then skeptics say, well, there are other people who did get hurt, and they're, you know, well, yes, but I mean, there's a limit to how much our free will be curtailed. But there's no doubt in my mind that I was specifically led and protected in ways that were beyond happenstance.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You say, I think later in the book, you worldliness, demonic, what is it? Demonic disorientation.
Diabolical
disorientation, right. Yeah. And conversion. And that diabolical disorientation, there's a kind of overlap. That is that from the period where you are fully kind of immersed in worldliness, there is something demonic there, but then you go through a divorce and you begin drinking, which mm-hmm. is kind of shocking because I shouldn't say kind of shocking, but it's a strange turn for you because you have committed never to drink,
right?
Having been the son of an alcoholic, your mother,
mm-hmm.
so all that involvement, drinking and drugs and all that, allows that demonic to flourish, but your conversion is overlapped by the demonic as well. It's not as if to say, well, oh, I walked into a church and it's all healed. I'm thinking of your relapse into taking a drink again comes after weeks, literally, of fasting during Lent.
And a general confession.
Yeah.
I drank again after that general confession that I made and after the deliverance. So how can I put this? I've seen it many times because in recovery now I've worked with a lot of alcoholics, and some of them that are in sobriety who know me say, I want to be Catholic now. I want to become Catholic. And there was one woman who had 10 years of sobriety. She was married and she seemed to be pretty solid. And she said, I want to do it. When I come back from France, I'm going to, you know, get me into RCIA at the mission San Juan Capistrano. And, you know, if you
right.
can't. And so she went and, you know, when she came back, she relapsed before she could enter RCIA. She'd had a lot of sobriety. What I find is that there are people who will go so far and they stand in the middle of the traffic instead of – and I did the same thing, and that's what almost killed me, you know, in the course of this narrative was I had seen the Mass in a new way. I was in the choir singing the old rite. I was introduced to like where is confession in Scripture? Well, John 20, 19 through 23, it's in there and it's real and you need a priest. And all of these things that I was being told are true, but I couldn't quite – accept it.
Uh-huh.
So I was playing around with very serious things, and so. But I think that the there may have been. I mean, why does God allow for possession? Why does God allow for some of these things to occur? It's a warning. We get to see something that we wouldn't otherwise see. And so when I drank again after my general confession and deliverance, it was vile. It was as though I my body wouldn't even accept it or tolerate it. So I was able then to Thomas Aquinas, the soul is comprised of the intellect and the will. And my will had been weakened and my intellect was darkened by the life of sin. This is classic Catholic theology. So I would need to because we have free will, we believe that as Catholics, not you know, some others do that, you know, all that other kind of stuff. We obviously have free will. And it was my will was not just even understanding that concept is helpful, that you have to make an act of the will to avoid sin. Yeah. Even if the confession worked or the deliverance worked, your will is still your will.
Right.
And I didn't really have that formation quite under my belt yet. I was all of these things were sort of experiential, and I hadn't really done the study,
yeah,
which I would later do, and then everything made sense. In that instance here, you know, the demons, if they're out there, knew that I'm capable of writing a book like this, that I'm crazy enough to witness to the Catholic faith in 2016. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm that crazy that I'll go out there and write a book and, you know, proclaim the truth of the Catholic faith. And so it would have been better if they could have just taken me and had me drinking again and dying of alcoholism instead of – because now there's this book.
Right.
And so, you know.
But I have to say, I think a lot of conversion stories do often – even when they're very sincere and people mean to give witness to what God has done in their life, they reach a tone of phoniness at a certain point because they won't admit that even after they met Christ, or they I shouldn't say they won't admit, they elide the point that even after they met Christ and even after Christ performed miracles in their life, they still reverted to the whatever that, you know, they went back and they, you know what, they fell into looking at the pornography again, or they fell into the, I don't know, being mean and angry again, or drinking again. And that what I loved in the book is that you present it as a matter of course. These things happened, the falling again happens, and that has no effect on Christ. He's still working. He's still, he didn't do this. Oh, come on, man. Look at everything I've done for you. And I'm done with you.
I think our working exorcists today have a great witness. There's a Father Peter Glass. I don't know if that's right. He's a Polish priest. And he said people will fall into the sin, say, of pornography after they've made a confession. They had a firm purpose of amendment. And then 2 days later, they're doing the same thing. And why is that? Well, the confession worked. They were forgiven of the sin, but their will hadn't changed. And he said also, too, the activity of the demonic is constant. So even though a person is protected in a state of grace, if they're having trouble with a sin like that and they won't be a daily communicant or they won't pray the rosary daily, they're leaving themselves too vulnerable. Even though the sacramental grace of confession is real, they need to protect their will. They need to strengthen their will more, say, with sacramental grace every day, with prayer every day. So he said that the spiritual warfare is maybe poorly understood. And we have a level of temptation or a level of demonic activity that I mean, it's you can feel it. I mean, it's alive and it's frightening in it, but it's very much in line with Catholic prophecy. I mean, was it Pope Leo VIII, you know, who composed the prayer to Saint Michael in the late 1800s, 1890s? You know, had that mystical experience where it seemed like there was going to be a definitive clash between God and Satan, right. And that there was this 100-year period where Jesus was going to allow Satan to act more dramatically upon the church. It seems like, you know, we're right at that point now. I mean, we're right here in the 100th anniversary of Fatima. You mentioned diabolical disorientation. That's a phrase that comes out of that apparition. And I think we may have left the period of disorientation, and now it's openly demonic, a lot of the things we're looking at. I'm not disoriented anymore. I'm looking straight into the face of pure evil.
And saying, yep.
And like, it's not hard to see.
Yeah, right.
And so it, in some ways, this is a good time to be engaged in spiritual warfare because it's not so subtle. It's right in our faces. So we can more easily choose. We can run to the sacraments, run to the sanctuary, run to and just understand too that our priests and everybody's been under this same level of attack, and we're all in it. Like, there was a period of time where I was angry that, well, why didn't they tell me, and what about this, and what about that, and well, you know, I mean, look at the 20th century. I mean, look at what happened to many of the Catholic countries in Europe. I mean, they were.
Yeah,
it wasn't just spiritual attack. They were blown up. You know, they were firing cannons at the Vatican in 1880. We're a little bit removed from how violent the attack on the church actually was in the 20th century.
Yeah,
and we sit here saying, "Why? Well, they're so. This person is so lackadaisical." Well, I guess it's up to us. You know, each individual person has to now make that stand, and we have to help each other because. We've all been weakened. I mean, the church has been weakened by this attack.
And people have lost. This is one of the things that another thing that I found a delight in the book is that what you come to is a faith in the actual power of the sacraments, right. Not in symbolic or, you know, community making power, all of which are good and beautiful, but the actual power of the sacraments to do what Jesus promised that they would do.
That's why I wrote the book. That's really the reason why I wrote it. I didn't write it to get something off my chest, or it's not an alcoholic recovery memoir. It's about the power of the sacraments, and in particular, confession and baptism.
Mm-hmm.
I do write about the Eucharist and how I had to come to my, you know, to really be able to confess the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ in the Eucharist. But I had a compelling experience with confession, reconciliation, and with baptism in a way that made both those sacraments really come alive for me. One, of course, was the confession I made and the deliverance, and I was sober, and I've been sober for almost 7 years, and it was supernatural. It mm-hmm. wasn't counseling. It was something happened. It was like it broke the back of that addiction mm-hmm. with the sacrament and with the deliverance. But then a half a year or more later, I was with a man who was a heroin addict and great guy. You know, he was self-medicating, childhood abuse and all kinds of problems. But he had a lot of trouble. He was going to go to jail for a long time. And, you know, he was about to die. And this is the last part of the book where I looked up in the catechism, well, what are the conditions for an emergency baptism? Because I always thought it was in danger of death. That's what I had heard. Or that's what I remembered. But when I read the catechism, it said grave necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, he's not going to RCA. This is a man who's going to die this week. And he told me before that he wanted to be Catholic. He was Jewish, but he believed in Jesus, and he wanted to, if he could survive this experience of his addiction and maybe prison. So I took him to a local church in Orange County, I dragged him there, and I had him kneel down, and I poured water over his head, and I baptized him in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, and it was like that his life turned around. I mean, the charges were dropped. you know, his wife came back. He got a good job. I mean, it was as if something had physically lifted off of him. And, and had I not seen that, you know, I can stand here now and tell people that these sacraments are channels of supernatural grace. So I was given – every person maybe gets a little glimpse. It's not so much that I have – I'm still walking by faith, not by sight.
Right.
But I saw these things and I thought, these sacraments are real.
Yeah.
This is real. And if that, if these are real, what else is real? Jesus is real. The deliverance ministries are real. Heaven is real. Hell is real. You know, it all started to come together that, hey, this is the foundation of Western civilization, the Catholic faith.
Yeah.
The greatest power that's ever come over the earth. Maybe I ought to give this a harder look.
Right.
I'm dying. I'm going to be dead soon. I mean, you know, what am I doing? What have I been doing with myself? And it was really a very visceral kind of a recognition, you know, of those two sacraments. And I've spent a long time since working on the Eucharist, you know, just sort of reading about it, studying about it, you know, kind of really trying to understand. And the Catholic Answers has some very good materials on it. But baptism and confession are very powerfully presented in Drunks and Monks because I had a very powerful experience with both of them. And if I had one reason for writing the book, it's that I want people to make a general confession. That's the main reason I wrote it, is I would love every Catholic to prepare for and make a general confession, and everybody else to convert and be baptized.
And make a general confession.
Yes, they need one. So,
yeah, right, right. And that's, you know, I have to say, John, it's out of the real belly of the beast you come, this, you know, entertainment lawyer for whom everything is wonderful and everything falls apart. But the central message, it seems to me, is the most profoundly anti-demonic message we can get. If you look at the history of the church in the modern era, 500 years of it, then you see the devil, the primary work of the devil is to try to separate people from the sacraments. And that is done that through the Protestant Reformation, and now has done it through a general kind of relativism and a spiritualizing that is anti-Catholic. And people don't know the power, and they don't, even if they know it, they kind of don't have confidence in it. The power of walking into that confessional and receiving absolution, or the power of the Eucharist before them.
And the interlocking way that all of these things fit together. And it's not that complicated, but just the reason why we have to be in a state of grace when we receive the Eucharist. And it's right there in St. Paul about, you know, people getting sick and dying because they're receiving the sacrament unworthily. I mean, when I read those things with fresh eyes, I'd heard some of them at Mass and when I was in Catholic school, but they just went right over my head. They didn't land. They didn't – but after I saw this and I thought, well, confession and communion work together. They're one hand washes the other in that sense. You need both. And what a beautiful thing. And I became a very powerful believer in the sacraments and everything that the whole system, the whole spiritual system of the Catholic faith, it's intricate, but it's not overly hidden or obtuse. It's strange, but it all makes sense if you're actually able to consider it rationally. You step back and say, well, there was this person named Jesus. We have a record of his institution of these various sacraments. The early church, Paul spoke about these things. The early church spoke about them. That we've been doing it. When did confession become optional? Are lines on Saturday so short and everybody goes to communion on Sunday? And what about the fasting? What about the prepper? And this isn't a criticism. This isn't – I don't want to get into any kind of controversial areas. But my witness is, if this is real, let's start acting like it's real and prepare ourselves the way Catholics are supposed to. And in different eras, not just in the modern era, there's a falling away. It happens. It happened in St. Francis's era. And then something has to happen or come along, or sometimes something very unpleasant that comes along. And it reminds people of the – and we're given, you know, this Eucharistic miracles, which I didn't know anything about. And right. it seems to be one every 50 years that it sort of aids us as we go through history where we get stale or dull or, you know, the scales cover the eyes again. And then there's a bleeding host suddenly somewhere.
Right, so, which is just a, more or less a giant arrow saying this is real.
Yeah,
you know, and the other thing is, people talk to God every day. Probably the majority of people talk to God every day, and God talks to people. And I think in general as Catholics, we're very cautious about the claim that it's almost. Upsetting or bothersome when someone says, oh, I was praying and God told me this. And this same person will tell you, like, it seems like God's speaking to them every single day. And you kind of feel like, well, or is that just your preference?
Yeah.
The reticence, the sense of God has spoken to me, but I don't want to talk about it. People is also really, like, we should be openly talking about this. That seems so genuine in this memoir was God's not constantly, John, do this, make a left, make a right, but God does miraculously speak to you or directly. I don't know if the miraculously is the right word, but very directly speaks to you, and that's you're not a crazy person for saying that.
Right. Well, just to speak to that, you hear a lot about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ or a personal relationship with God, and you know, we as Catholics, in addition to having a personal relationship in prayer, we have an ecclesial relationship with God and a sacramental relationship with God, and when I speak of two instances in the book where I received locutions, what I believe to be locutions and what my spiritual director told me were locutions. And they were pretty a locution is St. Teresa of Avila, our doctor of prayer, talked about these things. And she said they're often very short. They're unforgettable. They don't sound like your own interior voice.
Right.
And they don't come necessarily because you asked for them at a particular moment. They suddenly you get one.
Right.
And I had two. One was you should fast. And that came at the end of a 54-day novena. And I didn't put it together and I had never fasted and I didn't want to fast. And then my choir director gave me a book on fasting just out of the blue the following Sunday. And right. Suddenly we were experimenting with fasting.
I know.
Which I had never done. And so that was whatever this was, because in the 54-day novena, I was praying for healing, for help, et cetera. And the message was you should fast, not you should join a support group or you should you have another drink.
Right.
It was ancient. It was kind of an ancient fast, you know, you've got basically, and now looking back on that, if you're involved in one of those sensual sins, fasting, the ascetic practice is a good way to combat that. Maybe it wouldn't be the same for wrath or greed or it's good for everything, but especially if you're having trouble with gluttony and lust, et cetera.
So then
the other locution after the general confession was God needs you sober. Which was completely bizarre because I didn't really believe that I was an alcoholic, which is ridiculous. But that word sober that came to me in that way made me realize I was an alcoholic and I needed to be complete. I could never take another drink or drug again, which was – I didn't know how I was going to get from point A to point – so those are the two locutions that I believe I received. And then there was one that's not in the book that happened later. It was on Pentecost and I prayed to the Holy Ghost for some kind of guidance. And I felt that I got a third one, which was do justice to the people you've hurt. And so these types of answers are not – they're not warm and fuzzy.
Right,
they're not permissive.
Right.
But they're also not angry. That none of these things had an exclamation point after them. They were just out there.
Right. Calm. You used the word calm, I think, both times that the voice – that spoke to you. Is that the word calm or?
Yes, it was. There was a neutrality or an objectivity to it.
Right.
And it felt not so much like maybe a booming voice of God. It felt maybe more like a messenger.
Mm-hmm.
It felt maybe more like my guardian angel was authorized to drop a very specific thought into my head that was not my own. And then my free will is restored. You know, it isn't every minute that do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, because still I'm on the field of play. I'm still on the field of battle here. And what is this soul going to do now that he's not under the bondage of alcoholism, which will surely kill him? It seemed like the further off the track I was, the if I was sincerely praying for help, I would get the help that was sort of extraordinary. But when I came back more to the middle ground of, okay, you could do a variety of different things. You could enter religious life. Maybe you could have an actual Catholic marriage. Maybe you could be an evangelist. Maybe you could help your parents if they're asking you. You have, or you could always go back to the bar. You know, we don't want you to, but you're free. So there was. It isn't like I've. Those are the only three very direct, what I would call locutions. But I think there are things that happen. continually, you know, people are sent to your into your
right
sphere of influence. So you're either supposed to help them, or they're supposed to help you.
Right.
But some people maybe they show up and they're there to tempt you, which is an interesting idea too. You know.
Right. The time the locution came to you, you should fast. I recommend people read the book, and I won't say more about it. But there's a. I have to say it's almost funny. What accompanies that and the context in which that comes. And I'm not going to say anything more about it, John, because I don't want to ruin the book for people. But God is good and not at all put off by our humanity. It's that in very human situations, in very human ways, God shows us that he's there.
Yes, and you know, coming at the end of that 54-day novena, that was an arduous thing for me to do, to pray, you know, but it was almost like, oh, well, you want holiness now? You want, okay, so you're not running around Los Angeles drinking and you know, sneaking into bad places and being with people you shouldn't be with. And now you come and you want to be better. Okay, well, you should fast.
You know, I find that – I don't know why that brings me such delight, but it's just so – it's honest. It's I'm looking desperately for an answer. Here's the answer.
Yeah, and it was the next answer. It wasn't and then you're going to do this and then you're going
right.
to do that. It was just enough light to say step on this stone and not on that slippery one.
Right.
And it was like, well, what about – where does the path lead? So, you know, just this is all you can handle right now.
Yeah.
And either you'll take this leading or you'll reject it. And I took it to great effect. So
could I just read you a couple paragraphs of your own writing?
Sure.
And just ask you before we end to respond to these. Here you are far into your conversion and you're reading Thomas A Kempis's Imitation of Christ. And Thomas is writing about suffering born willingly. And then you begin to have this thought. I think of my floundering attempt to create a heaven on earth in Palos Verdes with my pretty wife and perfect job and Cadillac car and food finer than the kings of old could have eaten. Yet I found the cross straight away, right from the get-go. Not a trivial surface-level suffering, but a deep and soul-stretching sense of disappointment and confusion with every new achievement, every new pleasure come and gone. The emptiness. And then you say, you address Thomas A Kempis. Tell me more, Thomas A Kempis.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what that means to you?
Well, the passage that I was referring to in Imitation of Christ is one where it gives me chills. It's nice to hear my own writing read back to me. But as you are reading it, I'm getting chills up my spine because I'm remembering reading Imitation of Christ. My eyes are watering because that passage, which I haven't thought about in a while, has to do with he says, structure your life any way you want. Do this, do that. You will find the cross.
Yeah.
And if you reject that cross, you might end up with an even worse one. But it was this idea that no matter how you try to set things up, you're gonna find this. It's going to dig into your shoulder. And that's probably only if God loves you, because that awareness and it being raised in California as you were, it's a beautiful place. And so I would feel acutely, exquisitely lonely, say driving up the coast in Big Sur, say with a beautiful woman or whoever it was, and I'd see the waves breaking and I'd still feel that there was some longing, something missing.
Right.
And I couldn't do better than that. I couldn't do better than be born in California and be driving up the coast with somebody that I liked. And yet the longing was there even back when I was 24, 25, 21, 18. And so when I read this about a Kempis, I thought of my flight, that if I just did everything right, I'll have an enjoyable life. I'll enjoy my life and I'll be successful and people will admire me, you know, all of these things. And yet with every step, there was a cross. Uh-huh. And it was in a sense, reading a Kempis at 37 meant more to me than if I'd read it at 27. Because at 27, yeah. I was still, oh, no, the cross. No, I don't have any cross. I mean, I'm winning.
Yeah.
I'm having a great look at me. I'm just can't you just see how thrilled I am? But I was tense. I was, you know. But by 37, I realized that had been a fraud and the emptiness was there and that it was going to, you know, in responding to it, I would come to God or see that was our ultimate goal anyway. And we were not going to have a heaven on earth. That's not what this is. That's not where we are.
Right.
And so, you know, it was the beginning of wisdom, I guess, to read something like that. And it was just so thrilling to see that there was a work like that out there. Like, you know, Edith Stein, who converted, and I think she read something. I think it was St. Teresa of Avila. She might have read The Interior Castle. And it's always said that she read it, and she said, that's the truth.
Yeah.
And she converted.
Right.
And that was sort of when I was reading these works of the Doctors of the Church. I was just like, yep, check.
Right.
That happened. This, okay, yep, okay. And everything that had happened to me seemed to have a name in the Catholic.
Yeah, right. I remember that part. Yeah,
okay, a locution. Okay, it's good knowing this.
Yeah.
So, you know, but yes, that's what I was reacting to was that passage, and so what gets me excited is just the memory that you brought back to me of reading that for the first time. That no matter however you try to structure your life, you're going to find that cross. So you might as well take it up, and you know, you might as well go ahead and try to be a saint, because if you try to just enjoy your life, you're going to find the cross anyway. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, the book is Drunks and Monks. John Carmichael is the author. I recommend it to you highly. As I said at the beginning, Jennifer Fulweiler calls it the seven-story mountain of our times. My only hope for you, John, is that more people find the book, because it, not for your good. I mean, I'm sure it will do good for you, but for their good. It's such a pleasure to read it, and it has such a kind of sense of, yep, that's just how the world is today. And then at the end, it's got an escape hatch.
Right, right. We have a way to go. We have the way, right? The apostles used to call it the way, and we can go that way. It's there for us. But I will tell you, I'm going to be a lot more active, in part because of your urging, and you know, it's self-published, and I need to take some more responsibility for getting it out there. So thank you for that. Thank you for helping me with it too.
Yep, buy it and give it to your friends. Drunks and Monks, John Carmichael. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Si.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us again on Catholic Answers Focus. We do this every week. We hope to see you again next time on Catholic Answers Focus.